Yeah. Okay.
Some of the school.
I can show you to yeah. Okay. So okay. I can elaborate on that. Okay. So basically there is very little effect of phonons on the thermal conductivity of bosons because there are so few phonons. So the question is how monotonic the thermal conductivity of phonons is near the critical points, and that can be actually the material is remarkable in other respects. If you run thermal conductivity in the perpendicular direction, this is along the strong bond. If you run it along the perpendicular and along the weak bond, you see almost nothing. You see no additional thermal conductivity. It's very smooth. And
what you talk is additional.
Right, but from that picture, from that perpendicular direction, you can infer what phonons do, and you can claim that basically you can just it's an additional shift of both peaks by 0.2 or something. It doesn't do much. Okay. All right. Some of you who may still be with me can question me on the generality of this consideration because it's just one material. Okay, it's DTN, and it has no relevance whatsoever to the other BEC systems because it's nickel-based. It's not dimer-based. Okay, and the worry is that dimer-based materials don't have D. They don't have single ion anisotropy. Okay, and here I'm claiming that, okay, there is this behavior of these ratios of thermal conductivities, but the term driving it is that psi disorder. There's no psi disorder. Well, there might be some psi disorder for copper, but it has different meaning there. There is no magnetic term which is associated with it. So what about the other BC systems? Okay, actually the argument is very sleek, and I like it very much, because when you consider a dimer, the J within the dimer is your chemical potential. Basically, the mapping of dimers on the gas of bosons goes in by introducing one boson per bond, not one boson per site. So J is your large parameter, which is the main, if you start including random, frozen phonons of some sort, delta J will be your leading term here. J prime is the one responsible for the kinetic energy. This is your hopping. So the impurities there will be subleading. The purity effect on those will be subleading. But this one translates directly into on-site energy of the boson, and therefore it plays the same role as D. So again, the largest modification should be in the J here, and J plays the role of the on-site energy. So this picture should be applicable equally to all the BC systems. All right? Okay. So in the remaining 12 minutes, let me go quickly through the rest of my puzzles. Yeah, there are some experimental proposals we have.
You didn't explain the chemistry that leads to the Western microscopic origin for the disorder on B.
Frozen phonons, as I said. So it's bond variations. We don't know the particular site or whatever. It's somewhat complicated formula, but assume you have distortion of some element of the molecule here and there, and it will be enough.
Do you know what the mean free path is, right?
It's a tricky question. I should know, right? But okay, some estimates I had were giving me about 100 lattice spacings, but there is no sort of objective, experimentalist who would measure and just tell me what the mean free path is. Just divide, real numbers of kappa divided by specific heat. Well, actually, it's a little bit more complicated because you have parabolic dispersion. You have to think what the average velocity is at this temperature. So it's a temperature. Average velocity is a temperature-dependent thing. So it's not as straightforward. But it's my take is that it's rather long. It's between 10 and 100 meters.
Yeah. So for phonons, you'd never really think about point scattering at
at such low temperatures, it's all boundary limited.
Yeah.
Yet, you know, well, when you start introducing, you bring, you know, the spin excitations down, they start scatter phonons, as you can see, right? So yeah, your question. Okay. All right. So let me use my 10 minutes now. So let me go quickly through the evolution of the dispersion through the phase diagram and the evolution of the densities of states. So you can see this, you have a gap, you don't have a gap, and then your density of states is gets smaller at low energies. But actually what matters for, I want to switch to relaxation time now from relaxation from the mean free path. What matters is not the density of states, which is that piece here, but also the one which contains velocity. So let me call it the effective DOS, so DOS V square. And if you compare those for the gapless at the point, at the critical point, with the one deep inside the ordered phase, you actually see very little difference. There is just one half of a power of epsilon, which is different. And in fact, there are some other arguments along the line of what you just asked about the point-like scatterers. They become irrelevant inside the ordered phase because you have a linear dispersion there. So it's very puzzling to find that upon entering the ordered phase, you actually observe this somewhat intriguing minima. We have some field-dependent scattering, which is effective in these regions, which are absent outside and probably not as effective in the middle. And the other puzzle is the following. So let me take the phase diagram. This is specific heat and magnetocaloric effect, actually. Okay, and cut the phase diagram at each given temperature, which corresponds to these points, and find out what the actual HT1 and HT2 are, and put them on this data. And you can see that what happens is that initially you have specific heat and thermal conductivity having peaks around the same points, but then peaks in thermal conductivity start migrating away from the line of transition. Okay, so we call it peak migration problem, and just to mentioned delta H translates directly into the gap of your bosonic excitation. So let me address this problem first. So the problem of migrating peaks. As your temperature increases, you have to include some other scattering mechanisms. And the next in line is the scattering of bosons on each other. And one word about impurities is that, okay, it knows one over tau, not mean free path, knows about the velocity of your particle, but doesn't know anything about the gap. It's gap independent. It's actually temperature independent in the first approximation. Boson scattering, just to make this story a little shorter, it depends on the gap because, you know, if you make the gap large enough, there are no bosons. It's scattering on existing populations of bosons, so it should trace the population of bosons. Otherwise, it's actually weakly energy dependent, and there is some temperature prefactor as well. So it's enough knowledge for now, and let's just plug them in separately, actually impurity only first, and then impurity only plus impurity plus boson scattering. So if I have impurity only scattering, I take my kappa and normalize it to the leading temperature dependence of it, and count it, my vertical line now is my line of transition. So it's H minus HT2. And I just, you know, run integral, one-dimensional integral here and see what happens. So I see that nothing dramatically different happens at high temperature, some widening of the transition region, that's it. If I start including boson scattering, I actually start observing what the experiments seem to observe. And explanation is actually qualitative explanation is rather simple. So I would like to refer to it as a Goldilocks gap. So you have to bring, when you close down the gap, you bring scatterers, you bring heat carriers, but you also bring scatterers. So kind of the density of states argument tells you that this is, you know, well, it's good to have more of the particles carrying heat. But that argument tells you, no, don't bring too many, because it's going to be too hot. It's going to be too, it will be too much. So there will be intermediate solution to that. So there will be an optimal gap. And that seems to be a plausible explanation here. I can put a little bit more meat on that. Okay, one observation is that if your band is flatter, then this effect should be stronger. So this departure at HC2 must be stronger than at HC1, because mass is heavier there. Okay, so a different logic here, kind of a little bit more theoretical, if you wish, is that what this optimal gap could be. It's also the point where mean free path due to impurity scattering is about the same as mean free path due to boson scattering. Okay, and then you say, well, I know expressions for both, so let them just be equal to each other. Throw away all the coupling constants, so assume that coupling to impurities and boson coupling is the same, just to make things simple. And then you see that it's basically population of bosons being equal to population of impurities. That's what you're trying to match. And it's a nice expression because it contains delta in one place. And delta, as I said, is this delta H. You can invert it and then measure delta H and see whether this functional dependence, which is not a trivial one, it's T log T. It has a negative part, which means that at some low enough temperatures, your mean free path due to boson scattering never reaches impurity mean free path. And then it takes off with this quasi-linear slope. Okay, so you take this picture, you measure, and you put the data on. This is measured by my hands, so I put these error bars by hand, really. And I, for whatever reason, I felt that the bigger the data is, I should put bigger error bars. So you can actually check how nicely the fit works, especially for the HC, for the region above HC2. So it seems like this is not an orthogonal explanation, but not an orthogonal argument, but it's actually pretty clever argument, and it seems to fit what we have for the more, we don't feed the data that well because it requires putting more serious effort into kind of band structure calculation of the magnon band there. And I just didn't feel like doing that. But this argument seems to be much more quantitative than the previous one. So
HC1 doesn't seem to feed as well.
They're talking about zero, zero, and then it takes off. That's two data points. All right, last but not the least, okay? Just two more minutes, three more minutes. So where are these minima coming from? I like this kind of this last two slides because it relates to something I've been doing for quite some time, on and off. It's the following argument. It contains two pieces. This argument contains two pieces. First of all, you don't go from parabola to the straight line in just one, you know, at one point. You go from curvature, which we refer to as concave spectrum. While putting, you know, looking at from a different direction, it will be convex. Okay, so let me call it concave argument, the concave spectrum. So it's the spectrum which is bent upward. And you have this spectrum in the vicinity of HC1 and HC2. Okay, so it's basically parabola which wants to become a linear spectrum. And it's actually linear here, but then it has k cubed contribution to it, which is positive. Second piece of this argument is that, as I mentioned in the very beginning, I have ordered phase corresponds to the Brocken symmetry, and it's XY antiferromagnet in a field. It's a canted antiferromagnet. Your spins are pointing somewhat towards the field, but they also, you know, when they, before they condense, they can do this. Okay? So it's canted antiferromagnet. What does canting do? What canting does, it allows you to have coupling of longitudinal excitations on one side with transverse excitations on the other. In a maybe more general bosonic language, you have three boson couplings, which you don't have in the collinear antiferromagnets. In collinear antiferromagnets, your boson-boson, your magnet-magnet interaction is four magnet terms only. Okay? So what do these three boson terms do? Well, they allow you to have decays and recombinations as well. But for that, for decays to happen, you actually have to conform to certain kinematic conditions, which are known since 1958 for this spectrum by Belyaev and later Pitayevsky, that if you have this form of the spectrum, they looked at it from the point of view of a phonon in liquid helium, the two-particle continuum for that form of the spectrum is always below the single particle branch. So you can take one particle from here and actually split it in two if you have three boson terms. Okay? So it all seems to fall in one place because, first of all, in the paramagnetic phases, you don't have such terms because they're symmetry forbidden. You're not yet in the symmetry broken phase. Deep inside here, kinematic conditions cease to exist for the decays, so you don't have it anymore. But in the vicinity of HC1 and HC2, you may have it. And some preliminary calculations tell me that it's a range of 2-3 tesla and on, I think 3 tesla on this side and 2 tesla on that side, where you're allowed to have it. And some zero temperature calculations to for related model actually tell you that 1/tau has this interesting form which is leaning towards the HC. So it basically, it wants to almost saturate, but then it kind of drops down in a very narrow region. So if this is my cartoon of 1/tau, this is my even better cartoon of tau, which is something I need for it's, as I said, it's very preliminary consideration. So you can see a similarity of this deep with sort of inverted, it's not quite inverted, it's just flipped picture of tau, right? All right, I guess that's it. So DTN has provided us with one clear example of field-induced thermal conductivity in spin systems by spin excitation. And we have attempted, and I hope I convinced you that we also succeeded in explaining some of the features of this nice thermal conductivity data. And I hope more will come. Thank you.
Questions? Can you extract the phonon out and the pop a pure spin contribution? Since this ratio, you know, the phonon also become a temperature, so this ratio is
okay. Yeah, let me skip this. This is actually for those who like extrapolating kappa over t versus t square. This is inside the ordered phase, and if I'm not careful, I can also claim that I have a constant in kappa, but this is a different story, as you know. Okay, so let me sit at the critical points, so upper, lower, and this is my t square line, so this kappa over t versus t now. This is the fit of the phonon line, so this is the phonon contribution in zero field. Again, it's not the lowest temperature, but it actually fits pretty well by t to the power 2.7, as it should deviate from t cube. So you can see that this is not linear, and this contains some phonon contribution, but it also contains significant t square contribution. Okay, so I didn't attempt to separate them, but let me show you different things. So actually, this is the double peak, a la Pomeranchuk. Okay. So this is the picture of kappa along the strong direction. This is the picture of kappa along the weak direction. It's essentially featureless, and it actually conforms to these other experiments which show nothing but kind of phonon contribution. Explanation is simple. Roughly speaking, you have V square standing here. Again, if you assume that your relaxation time is the same for both directions, direction independent, then you roughly speaking have V square, and there's a factor of five between V's in this direction and that direction. So you basically, there might be some spin contribution in the transverse direction, but it's just buried. It's 25 times less. Okay. So, but what you can do with this data, it basically tells you that what phonons do. So you first, the lowest temperature is nothing, and then it kind of, you know, you close the gap, it starts being scattered by magnetic excitations, then it's flat. Okay, so what you can do, you can say, well, I can scale it using the knowledge of anisotropy of phonon thermal conductivity in the along the strong and the weak axis, and add it up to that previous slide over here. So you can do this. And you can ask all kinds of questions, whether my migration of peaks changes and it doesn't, whether, you know, whether the minima.
This one would be roughly the pure spin contribution.
Yes. So here, rough, you know, this is, you know, in some other systems like cuprates, what they do, they use the other direction to subtract phonons. What I do here, I add phonons, if you wish, to that picture. So it's, again, quantitatively, it might be, you know, you should probably put some error bars here on this procedure. But if you do it kind of many different ways, I don't think you're getting many different answers. So the peaks are about, you know, the ratio of the peaks didn't change. Yeah, I spent some time thinking of this experimental data, probably more than Alex Logubenko himself.
Well, yeah, I was wondering how generic you think your arguments about the insensitivity of the kappa to the effective mass might be, because in other quantum critical materials, you see divergence of a specific heat.
Yeah.
So essentially the thermal conductivity is really well behaved and doesn't seem to sort of diverge in the same way you might expect an effective
yeah.
to. So any of your arguments?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of it's like you're asking me to answer the question about the generic material. And without letting me know what material is, but it's there might be one of the reasons I know why thermal conductivity behaves as almost nothing. You know, it actually, you can see that this is a transition point. I don't know why it died. But there is no singularity here. While if you look at the specific heat, there is a peak, right? So the question is, why is it happening? Well, when you have mean free pass, which is k-dependent, which is for this problem not the case if you have impurity scattering, but it is the case when you start including boson scattering. You have k-dependence in the mean free pass, meaning that some of your particles do feel these critical fluctuations, but some of them don't. So you kind of, and they integrate over all of them. So you kind of smooth it out. So it's not the it's not the mass issue. It's a different issue.
Other questions? Sasha's at the department tomorrow. So if you feel like you missed out on some Sasha love, come catch him at the department. And let's thank him once more.